legal system and the judiciary operate, how our wider institutions, including the media, operate, the ability to challenge power and to be able to ask questions and, above all, to make decisions for yourselves based on evidence and being able to question that evidence. And I think it would be criminal to do away with that citizenship as part of the curriculum, and that's what they're in danger of doing at the moment. And it would be completely contradictory, because if David Cameron believes in big society, whatever way you want to describe that, I happen to believe that a functioning civil society and community is absolutely vital. I believe heavily in community action and volunteering and people playing a part in their own decisions and their own lives. If you really want that, and you want young people to do citizenship volunteering at the age of 16, then you can't do it in a vacuum. You can't just pick it out of the air. So a good citizenship curriculum will lead young people to want to be involved and engaged, and will help them to understand how they can make that contribution more effectively. So I hope we can campaign on that as well.
Hi, I was just wondering what your, and if you can give it, Labour Party's position is on the possibility of a Robin Hood tax.
Well, Gordon Brown was flirting with this and trying to get some engagement. It's been called all sorts of things: the Tobin tax, the Robin Hood tax, the tax on financial transactions. It would only have to be a very small levy on each financial transaction organised globally for us to raise very large sums of money. It would be sensible for that to be done in our case on a Europe-wide basis, which would then could be earmarked for European funding instead of levying on individual states. So that would immediately relieve funding for protecting public services, which are under attack. And it could be earmarked for very specific items, such as protection of the environment and combating climate change. So there would be a real opportunity to do things which would otherwise not be feasible. And there's a complete logic in having a tax on financial transactions, because of course we do on our normal transactions, like levying VAT on purchases we make from local shops. So the logic of doing this is overwhelming. The organisation to get it agreed is a much more difficult matter, because it would have to be global decision making, not just an individual country.
What would you say were the differences between Blair and Brown's leadership style, as you have worked under or close to both?
Well, Tony was much more relaxed. I mean, Tony enjoyed being Prime Minister and Gordon didn't, in my view. Tony was able to turn things round by having a sense of humour, whereas Gordon got angry about them. The strange thing is that they were both perfectly reasonable and affable individuals in private. I mean, I knew both of them, and still know both of them, very closely. I stayed with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown in their own homes. Well, Tony at Chequers and Gordon in his house in Scotland. And it was perfectly easy to get on to talk seriously, to have a joke, to be able to talk about lighter issues. But it was much more difficult to get Gordon to do that in any kind of formal situation. So I think Gordon found being Prime Minister extremely hard work. And there's no question of the commitment he made. I mean, he was working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. But if you are working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you don't have any light relief, Tony used to play tennis and swim and play with the kids, and Gordon used to work. And after a bit, it does make you fairly dour. You know, I got a bit dour when I was Home Secretary, because I was working 7.5 days a week. And when I stopped being Home Secretary, friends of mine in Sheffield said, "It's nice to have you back." I said, "I didn't know I'd left." But I clearly had. So, I mean, that shows. David Cameron clearly enjoys being Prime Minister. Whether the rest of us enjoy him being Prime Minister, another matter, but he clearly does, which is partly about background. I mean, Tony Blair and David Cameron and Nick Clegg all went to public schools, and it builds confidence, and it builds actually, you can see this over the generations, it builds a belief that you're born to rule, so you're comfortable with power and confident with it. And we've got to build confidence and ease with taking decisions and being comfortable with getting involved with power with all of us and not just them.
Hi, I just wanted to ask about getting young people involved in politics. Recently, I've sort of had many discussions with some friends about sort of conspiracy theory type things where, you know, there are certain people in power and whatever you do doesn't matter. And sometimes you hear these theories echoed by politicians themselves. So I was just wondering, how do we get young people involved in politics? And also sort of keep up this sort of the BBC aren't really neutral, that type of thing.
Mm. Well, conspiracy theories abound, and of course the rise of the internet's helped that enormously. You can log on and find conspiracy theories about just about anything going, really. I think the answer is to encourage people to feel that they're being part of political change when they get involved in local and not just in big national or global issues. In other words, that change can be brought about at a local level, getting involved with what's happening in the neighbourhood and community, being part of social action is being political. Secondly, just to make a judgment over time as to what political action has made a difference. I mean, you are right that politicians sometimes reinforce this. There's a very famous historic Labour politician, who you'll have heard of, called Aaron Bevan, who said that he got on the parish council in Wales and he discovered the power was at the district council. And he got on the district council and then he discovered that the real decisions, because they of where the power lay, was at county level. So he got on the county council and discovered he really ought to be in Parliament. And when he got in Parliament, he realised it was being in Cabinet. And when he got in Cabinet, he realised he ought to have been Prime Minister. So he did build up a picture of power slipping through your fingers. There's no question whatsoever, having been the leader of a local authority, I had not power, but real influence over changing the lives for the better of the people of Sheffield. We did really good things that I'm proud of. When I was in Cabinet, we did really good things. Some of them we've mentioned this afternoon. You know, I'm really proud of my involvement in creating Sure Start, in Child Trust Fund, in EMAS, in the massive expansion of university education, in the New Deal for Young People on employment, and in things like the Literacy and Numeracy Strategy that some of you will have experienced at the end of your primary period. Those are things that were really making a difference. And I think you need to say to your friends, what is making a difference? Of course, power makes a difference in terms of wealth and privilege. And that's what politics is combating. That's what Bernard Crick's In Defence of Politics book was all about. That power lies in the hands of those with wealth. Power lies with multinational companies. Power lies, although they've taken a drubbing, with decisions made by the very large investment banks. But the counterweight to that is our form of politics, is getting involved, is participation, is voting, is getting people elected to Parliament, to the local council, who really care, who will give a voice for those who don't have wealth and privilege. So our form of politics is a counterweight to the power that exists elsewhere, and we should use it. And if we don't, we allow the rich and powerful to continue being rich and powerful.
I'd just like to ask what your feelings are. Do you have any feelings on the success of the AV system in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's a very complex system. You've seen the election in Southern Ireland. They have a fully fledged proportional single transferable vote system in the Republic of Ireland. I think the AV system applied in Northern Ireland would lead to some interesting outcomes. It may lead to the Alliance Party, for instance, getting more of a show. It might actually lead to Sinn Féin doing a lot better than they're already doing in the as they did in the Assembly elections. It won't make any difference whatsoever to elections to Westminster because of the nature of the constituencies and the demographic and religious makeup of those Westminster constituencies. So it would be more of an influence in relation to the Northern Ireland Assembly. But if you look at the proportional system in the Irish Republic on their election last week, you could see the enormous complications and how that works out. It's you're bound to have a coalition. There's no other outcome. Even with a massive swing to Fianna Gael, they still couldn't make it without having to go into coalition.
What's the
one thing you're most proud of having achieved as a politician, and what's your biggest regret? I'm proud of quite a lot of things. I mean, funnily enough, I'm probably proudest of something I was involved in when I was leader of Sheffield, which was the creation of the transport system in South Yorkshire, which provided free transport in the city centre. Young people could travel for 2p anywhere. You could travel anywhere in Sheffield for 10p, and it was liberating in every sense of the word. And we kept that going for 14 years until the government in 1986 destroyed it. My biggest, I've got one or two regrets about not pushing things harder. I think my biggest regret was probably in the Home Office not changing the whole system of youth justice so that we didn't actually engage much more with massive interventions to prevent young people who'd started to rub up against the law getting more deeply involved. I think if we'd had more imaginative policies to intervene in the lives of those young people and to turn them round, we'd have done a big favour for them, but we'd have done a big favour for society as well.
As a teacher, I'm quite worried about the government's attack on teachers' pensions and the proposals to change contributions, whereby we'll pay more in contributions and actually get less money in retirement. This goes against what was agreed with the Labour government. What is your stance on this, and what is the Labour Party proposing to do to try and, I don't know, avert this attack on pensions?
Well, I was a teacher. I mean, I taught in post-16 education and got PGCE many, many years ago to that effect. So you'd expect me to be with you on it. I saw the head, Brian Lightman, of the College Leaders Union just yesterday about this. And Andy Burnham, who's a friend of mine, who's our Shadow Education Secretary, is very keen to work with the teacher unions and to see if we can combat this, given that we've already made agreed changes with the teachers' pension and retirement arrangements. So it's not as if change hadn't taken place, and it's not as if it isn't a fully contributory scheme. I was able to carry my teachers' pension into my House of Commons pension, so I'm very lucky. And I think that I should defend other people's pensions when those pensions are equal to or lesser than my own pension. In other words, I have a very clear rule of thumb in life, including in my own constituency. If I wouldn't put up with it, I don't expect other people to.
We've got time just for one or two questions, because we want to make a little bit of time for you to be interviewed by politics. So just have the last couple of questions.
Do you want to take the two together, and I'll try and do a sharp answer?
Okay, so Hazmat and then Shirley.
Yeah, there's there's many bad plans to David Cameron, yeah, so he's going to be in government for what, the next 5 years? So what advantages is he bringing, because he's going to be here for a long time?
Well, that's a tricky one. Anyway, what's the second one while I think about the answer? Sure.
Why did you get involved in politics?
Okay. I think on the first question, the only benefit that the coalition and David Cameron's premiership brings us is stability. And although I don't like the form of stability it's bringing for the next 4 years, I think there are some underlying examples, and I've talked about this on many occasions, because I think philosophically stability and certainty are pretty crucial at times of instability and insecurity and fear, and therefore at least we have a knowledge of what we're dealing with and the problem, I mean, whether we like it or not, what the terms of reference are for the next 4 years. Whereas if we had a minority government with total instability, we'd probably have a second general election. God knows what the outcome of that would be, but it would probably lead to even less coherent decision-making. I think we've got incoherent decision-making and contradictions, but it could even be worse if that could be possible than it is at the moment. You asked me, I'm trying to give you an honest answer, because I'd rather he wasn't there, even though I think he, within his own terms, he's quite good at it. What got me into politics was my dad was killed in a works accident when I was 12. My granddad died in a horrendous accident in an old people's geriatric unit. My mum was completely up against it. We had no money. And I was just very angry. I wanted to change the world. I saw the people around me working very hard. It was at a time of full employment. People worked very hard for very little and were treated badly. And I just wanted to change the world, and I still do. And that's what got me involved in politics. I found two things. Firstly, it was very satisfying. And secondly, it was deeply frustrating, because the things I wanted to do, I wasn't able to do quickly. The things I wanted to do, I had to persuade other people of my point of view. And that can be very irritating and frustrating. And that's what the art of debate and the art of democratic politics is about. It distinguishes us from dictatorships. We have to persuade each other. And we must continue learning the art of persuasion and of being able to win our point of view, argue our point of view, debate our point of view. And in the end, you know, democracy is not so much about electing people, it's the ability to get rid of us. You know, dictators have managed to win plebiscites, referenda, but it's when you can get rid of a government, when you can change your politicians, or even when you can change their minds. People have changed my minds over the years, both inside my constituency, which I love. I mean, my constituency have stood by me through thick and thin, and they're fantastic people, and when I go back at the weekend, I get renewed and refreshed. Just in my constituency, and on big issues, on issues relating to the politics of Ireland, I had my minds changed. On issues relating to equality for gender, I had my mind changed. And that's how it should be, and that's what makes politics both vital to our democracy and a fascinating thing to be involved in.
Thank you so much, Mr. Blunkett from B6. We thank you for coming to meet us today and taking out your time to meet us. It's been a pleasure having you. Thank you.
Yes, if you want people to come and sit with me.
I'm over here. One or two people who want to take the project, so I can sack the door.